Yenta says, "Now listen up. I talked to Sheldon Harnick."
"Hi,
I'm Julian Fleischer. You are about to listen to the podcast version of the Naked American Songbook. Now, due to copyright law, we can't provide all the music for on-demand listening. It sucks. We're bummed about it, too, and we're working on it. But for the moment, you can still hear my conversation and get a little taste of the music that he loves. So unbuckle up, because here we go." Greetings, fellow citizens of the global Anatevka. Gratitude, it's the cornerstone of our humanity, the highest of the emotional arts. It's the reason for the season. Yet getting and staying thankful is surprisingly challenging, especially for something with such high yield. So little goes so far. So here's a little gratitude for you. I am grateful to my guest today on the Naked American Songbook. Up until this episode, we've talked almost exclusively with consumers of the songbook. Some singers, yes, but fans mostly. No actual makers of songs. Well, that all ends today as I'll be talking with one of the genuine giants of the great American songbook, Sheldon Harnick. Legendary lyricist of such shows as She Loves Me, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Fiorello, and of course, one of Broadway's all-time great masterworks, Fiddler on the Roof. I honestly don't know where to start. I'm morally certain that I speak for most American Jews when I say that I don't know what being Jewish means without the songs from Fiddler. I mean, how do you get bat mitzvahed or married, celebrate the Sabbath, or even bury your dead without these eternal songs? What in Hashem's name did Jewish people sing before Fiddler on the Roof? The music from this show is in our very DNA. And not just Jews. The show has been produced thousands of times in about as many languages. For God's sake, it's especially big in Japan. Yes, I said big in Japan. But for a secular, skeptical Jewish boy from Baltimore such as myself, with a lot of other things on my mind, these songs provide a connection to a tradition that really has no equal. And for that, I am grateful. I'm also awestruck to be able to express my gratitude to the man himself. But how do you thank someone who's taken you from crayons to perfume? It isn't easy, but I'll try. Thank you, sir. I'm Julian Fleischer, and this is the Naked American Songbook. Title song from To Sir With Love, the quintessential Sidney Poitier vehicle from 1967. I love everything about this track. The tremulous strings, the strummy little guitar, and of course the raw quivering vocal by the one-name Scottish wonder, Lulu. And while it is not written by my guest today, it does express much of what I'm feeling sitting across the table from him.
After that introduction, I'm disappointed that I don't hear applause.
I want to talk to you, obviously, about the songs that you love and the music you grew up with, the kinds of writing that influenced your work. But before I get there, I just feel like my mother wouldn't forgive me if I didn't say thank you for an entire lifetime of music. I was talking with one of my producers who's behind the glass there, And we were saying today that I don't think either of us would even know what it means to be Jewish without the music of Fiddler on the Roof.
It's, oh, thank you. That's a lovely thing to say. Thank you.
Thank you. It's quite serious. I mean, what would we sing if you had not written these songs? Can you imagine what we'd be doing? We'd be lost in the desert.
They'd probably be Johnny Mercer songs.
Ah, you like Mercer?
I love Mercer because he has both humor and he obviously cares very much for words, always so carefully chosen. And what he has to say is always so intelligent, meaningful.
But I had my share of rhythm songs when I was a young man. They might seem corny now, but they were quite hip for those days.
There's a song that comes back to me. I think it's called Spring, and it has many, many verses. They're just so inventive, constantly inventive. They're wonderful.
Yes, sirree, spring discloses that it's all when supposes wagon tails, mother noses, but it's no bed of roses. If for the starcupine, consider the porcupine who longs to cling. Keeping company is tricky, it can get pretty sticky in spring, spring, spring.
But for another song, let's say Laura. Laura is just haunting. And I understand that he hadn't even seen the movie when he wrote the lyric. And yet it fits that movie like a hand fits a glove. It's just wonderful.
Is there a version that comes to mind?
The one I sing.
Oh, really?
No. I love it musically and lyrically.
Who wrote the melody for Laura? That's not...
David Raxon. Yeah.
No wonder.
Film writer, yeah.
Of course, my listeners will be not surprised to learn that the version I know is the Ella Fitzgerald version.
Oh, I see.
Because I find it so platonically ideal. You know, she always seems to get it exactly right.
She was so musical.
Well, what are you going to do about Ella Fitzgerald? Let's listen to what she does with Laura, music by David Raxon and words by the great Johnny Mercer.
Laura is the face in the mist. Footsteps that you hear down the hall, the laugh that floats on a summer night that you can never.
Ella Fitzgerald and the haunting theme from the 1944 classic film noir masterpiece Laura. Music by David Raxon, lyrics by Johnny Mercer. Sheldon, when you're listening to a song like that, are you thinking about the writing, the words, the song construction?
No, I'm just enjoying it.
Really?
Well, it depends what the song is, of course. Sometimes if it's a Sondheim song from a show, I will enjoy the song and I will enjoy the craft of it.
Mm-hmm.
But a song like Laura, one just enjoys. It's just a beautiful song.
I wonder what the difference is.
I think it's the point for which the song was written. A commercial song or a song that was meant, I'm sure when they wrote it, they were hoping for an Oscar. The point was to write a beautiful song. So I listened to a beautiful song. But show songs are the kind of songs that I try and write, that Sondheim writes, that theater writers write, are meant to do something more than just be beautiful. Hopefully, they have intelligent lyrics, and they're meant to be understood and appreciated.
So you've written both commercial songs and show tunes.
Not very many commercial songs. When I first came to New York, that's what I thought I was trying to do, but I discovered that I don't have that talent. My talent is for the book song, the song that pushes the plot forward. It's not the Irving Berlin type of talent.
Interesting. I would think that your talent would be the more difficult one. It requires more work, doesn't it?
I like to think so. As a matter of fact, when I first came to New York, through an uncle of mine, I had an introduction to one of Yip Harburg's composer collaborators. I'm blocking on his name right now. And he told me, try and write ballads, because that's what Broadway producers want, is good commercial ballads. And I thought, okay, I guess that's true. Then I met my hero, my god, which was Yip Harburg. And I mentioned this to Yip, and he said, no, that's not the case. He said, what a producer of a show wants to know is, can you write a comedy song, and can you write character songs? Can you write the songs for the drama? He said, it's wonderful if you can do a good ballad, too, but that's less important for the success of the show than the other kinds of songs, the dramatic songs and the comedy songs.
And I take it you feel that Harburg was right.
I feel that Harburg was right.
How did he become your hero?
Ah, that's an interesting story. When I got out of the Army, this is around 1945, I thought that I wanted to be a fiddle player. That's what I had been working towards all my life. I enrolled in Northwestern University, and I went to Northwestern for two reasons. One was that it had the violin teacher I wanted to study with, a man named Robert Quick, who had been the associate concertmaster of the Chicago Symphony. Wonderful teacher and a wonderful man. And it had the college show, which I'd seen, the WAMU show, which was like a professional review.
Interesting.
I had started to write songs by then, so I wanted to contribute songs to it. My first year there, I had one song accepted, and it was sung by a woman who became a very good friend and a very important performer, a woman named Charlotte Ray.
People will know her from television.
Yeah.
From The Facts of Life, am I right?
That's right, yeah.
She was the house mother.
Anyway, we became very good friends. And in our junior year, Charlotte had gone to New York on the Christmas holiday. And when she came back, she sought me out. She had an LP in her hand. And she said, Sheldon, you of all people have to hear this. And she loaned me her copy of Finian's Rainbow.
Wow.
I listened to that. And the music by Burton Lane was wonderful, but it was the lyrics. The lyrics changed my life. I listened to those lyrics and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to try and write lyrics like that rather than play the violin.
Lyrics like that meaning what?
Meaning that they were clever, that they dealt with serious subjects, but they dealt with those subjects so playfully and so entertainingly that I thought, the trick is to make people listen whether they agree with you or not. They have to be entertained. And I thought that's a goal that's well worth striving for.
Sounds like you might have made a good lawyer, too.
Well, that album literally changed my life. I didn't quit school. I finished. I got my degree. But then Charlotte, by that time, was in New York. And she had written me a letter saying, Sheldon, I meet a lot of young writers because I'm looking for club material all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I think you could have a real career here. And that was one of the influential opinions that made me go to New York.
Is there a lyric from Finian's Rainbow that stands out in your memory that just pops into mind as particularly exemplary?
When the idle poor, or when the idle rich, rather.
Uh-huh.
See, he's my idol and I got his lyric wrong.
But at least you got it wrong in the right way.
Yeah, that is a brilliant number. But the whole score is just an extraordinary score. I just saw a production of it down at the Irish Repertory Theater. They'd made trims in the book, so it really skipped along. But I took my son, who had never seen it, and I was very pleased. At the end of the show, he turned to me and said, now I see why this was so influential in your life.
This is the original Broadway cast?
Yeah.
When the idle poor become the idle rich, you'll never know just who is who or who is which. Won't it be rich when everyone's poor relative becomes a rocker relative and palms no longer itch? What a switch!
When we all have vermin and plastic teeth, how will we determine who's who underneath?
And when all your neighbors are upper class,
you won't know your Joneses from your Esters.
Let's toast the day we drink our drinky up, but with a little pinky up,
the day on which the
rich man doesn't want to work,
he's a bon vivant.
Yes, he's a bon vivant.
But when a poor man doesn't want to work, he's a loafer, he's a lounger, he's a lazy good for nothing.
He's a jerk.
When a rich man loses on a horse, isn't he the sport?
Oh, isn't he the sport?
But when a poor man loses on a horse, he's a gambler, he's a spender, he's a lowlife, he's a reason for divorce. When a rich man chases after James, he's a man about town, a man about town. But when a poor man chases after James, he's a bounder, he's a rounder, he's a rutter and a lot of dirty names.
You'll never know just who is which when the idle poor become the idle rich.
When the idle poor become the idle rich.
When the idle poor become the idle rich, you'll never know just who is who or who is which.
You can see why that would change my life.
I guess I can.
Yeah.
That was Ella Logan and the original cast of Finian's Rainbow. And that's the very recording that you're talking about.
That's the very recording I'm talking about. I've stayed friends with Charlotte Ray. And when I came to New York, she called me one day. She was working at the Village Vanguard. And she said, through a friend, they had invited Yip Harburg down to see her show, and he was coming. So if I wanted to meet him, I should come down that night. And I did. I went down there. He couldn't have been nicer. And I asked whether I could audition my songs for him. He said, sure. Mm. So I went to his apartment. I was a fiddle player. So I got a pianist. I went to his apartment. And he gave me some lovely advice. And then he did something. I'm old enough now and I've been around enough now to realize how generous it was. About 3 days after I played for him, I got a card from him in the mail. It was a greeting card, and then the cover was a funny picture of a woman playing the harp with her bare feet. But the message inside was, Dear Sheldon, things will go well for you if you keep wanging that lyre. Signed, Yipper.
Oh my
and
Lord.
I treasure that card.
I gotta tell you, I just gotta chill. I assume you still have this card.
Yes, I do, absolutely.
And did you maintain a friendship with him over the years?
Yes and no. I rarely met him. When I did, it was always very friendly. He would ask how things were going. But he didn't become a mentor in the sense that he called me and offered advice. We just knew each other. And I would occasionally see him at an opening night or something like that.
Can you tell me what advice he might have given that was helpful?
He looked at the music that I gave him, and he commented, he said, a lot of what you've written, the introductions are kind of recitatives, and you save your melodic ideas for the chorus. Don't do that. He said, every note should be as beautiful as you can make it, because even in a comedy song, he said, the first time people hear a comedy song, if it's funny, they'll laugh. But the second time, they know the jokes. They're not going to laugh. What gives the song legs is its music. So you must make the music as beautiful, every note, as you can. And that was a wonderful piece of advice.
So you had written the melody as well as the words in this case?
At that time, I was writing my own music, yes. And the other thing he said, your music is fine, but if you get invited to collaborate with other composers who you respect, don't hesitate to do that because it will be an avenue to further productions, and it's just a good experience. So I took that literally, and I did write with a number of people. Eventually, through an actor named Jack Cassidy, I met Jerry Bock, and that he became my partner until he died.
Believe me, a lot happened between those two events, and we're going to hear more about the story of Sheldon and Jerry. But now we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear more about the music that came from their beautiful partnership. I'm Julian Fleischer, and this is the Naked American Songbook. Just a few minutes ago, we heard a Burton Lane Yip Harburg tune from Finian's Rainbow, a tune that set Broadway lyricist Sheldon Harnick's heart aflame when he first heard it. Now, if you're like me, you may have been reminded of Gilbert and Sullivan by that song, and I asked Sheldon if he was a fan of the great British operettists.
Gilbert and Sullivan was also a tremendous influence in my life. As a matter of fact, as a violinist, it was what led me to musical theater. While I was still in high school, people who were connected with amateur musical theater groups around Chicago, where I'm from, they would come to the high schools, the colleges, be looking for people who would work for free because they had small budgets. And I volunteered. So I played for a couple of companies that did Gilbert and Sullivan. It was my introduction to Gilbert and Sullivan. And sometimes while I was sitting in the orchestra pit, the director would say, "Orchestra, layout, I just want to work with the piano for a minute." And so I would sit and listen. And, of course, the things that appealed to me first were the patter songs.
Right.
Because that kind of lyrical brilliance was so immediately apparent. And then little by little, I began to appreciate the poetry of other lyrics that weren't just brilliant, but that were wonderful poetry. So it was as a violinist sitting in the orchestra pit listening to a rehearsal that I began to appreciate the lyrics for musicals.
When I sing, sometimes I do like a swinging version of Titwillow. I love that tune because it's got that jazz waltz feeling.
Yeah, I did Titwillow on the Upper West Side at Symphony Space. They did the Gilbert and Sullivan program, and they had an orchestra, and I was invited to sing Titwillow with the orchestra.
Oh, man.
That was a thrill. It was a real thrill.
I love that tune very much. It's such a good story.
On a tree by a river, a little bird sat singing willow, Titwillow, Titwillow. Yeah, it's a great song.
This is a song about a bird who kills himself.
Yeah.
We have a recording of none other than Groucho Marx singing Titwillow.
So Groucho recorded it.
From the Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan. It's a little bit funny. It's a little bit sad. Here's Groucho Marx.
On a tree by a river, a little Tom Tit sang willow, Titwillow, Titwillow. And I said to him, "Dickie bird, why do you sit singing willow, Titwillow, Titwillow? Is it weakness of intellect, birdie?" I cried, "or a rather tough worm in your little inside?" With a shake of his poor little head, he replied, "Oh, willow, Titwillow, Titwillow." He slapped at his chest as he sat on that bough, singing willow, Titwillow, Titwillow. And a cold perspiration bespangled his brow. Oh, willow, Titwillow, Titwillow. He sobbed and he sighed, and a gurgle he gave. Then he plunged himself into the billowy wave. And an echo arose from the suicide's grave. Oh, willow, Titwillow, Titwillow.
Oh, what a treasure that is.
And who better to sing a song about a suicidal songbird?
Groucho Marx doing Titwillow. Oh, I'm blown away.
That's great. Oh,
that was wonderful. I only wish that Harpo had accompanied him.
Oh, that would have been nice. We're going into a new era in American politics. I think we all know that. The ship has turned sharply to the right. And I'm curious what you think about music and art's response to politics. What is the place of a songwriter in a time of difficult politics?
It's a tough question, because even in a period where you're happy with the politics, where you're happy with leaders, still, when you write a satirical show, you have to be very careful that you don't let your own beliefs take over. Mm-hmm. You have to always remember that you're trying to entertain people, and that the message, in a way, is secondary to the entertainment value. In a period where the leaders may not be the people you would particularly want in office, I suddenly remembered something, which was a lesson I learned. I had written a very political song. I came to New York in 1950, and I had an opportunity to try and repair lyrics in some review, and I was able to sell them on doing this song, which is a very political song. And when it was performed, the audience was quite hostile to it. I could tell their laughs weren't there, and I could sense a resentment in the audience. And it was a very important lesson because I thought, I haven't done my job. I have been so busy expressing my own beliefs that I haven't paid attention to the entertainment values. These people are not liking the song, and justifiably. They don't believe it. They don't think as I do, so they haven't been entertained. Next time I write something, I damn well better make sure that there are values in the song that anybody, whatever their political beliefs in, that anybody can laugh, can respond to. So it's harder in that kind of politics, but it's possible.
Huh.
And as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that I admire about Gilbert and Sullivan, because Gilbert had a lot of things to say, but he couched them in such entertaining ways that even if you disagreed, you had to laugh. You had to respond.
Right, of course. I want to get back to that major partnership in your career, the one with Jerry Bock.
Yes. Yeah. The first time I met him, I had been called in to try and repair lyrics for a musical based on Shangri-La, which is where I met Jack Cassidy. And Jack was a very close friend of Jerry Bock. And he told me that Jerry, this was kind of weird. Jerry had a lyric partner named Larry Holofcener. And all of us who were lyricists knew that Sammy Davis was doing a show called Mr. Wonderful and that the second act would be his nightclub act, but the first act would be a new musical. And we all wanted the job to work with Sammy Davis. Well, Jerry Bock and Larry Holofcener got the job, and they did a very good job. They had a couple of hit songs. And for some reason, after that show opened, they broke up, which was a surprise to me because I thought they've got a hit show. Why are they breaking up? But at any rate, it turned out that Jerry was looking for a new lyricist. And when I met Jack Cassidy, he said, I want you to meet my friend Jerry Bock. So we met, and we got along instantly and famously and began to work together.
I understand. I heard a story from a friend of mine up at Lincoln Center that you would send each other tapes?
It always started with him sending me a tape with maybe 8 to 12 numbers on it. And I thought he was extremely generous because on any tape, there might only be two songs that I really felt I could use. But that would be the way we would start. I would start with music. And at a certain point, I would have an idea for a song, and there was no music. And I would think, okay. And I remember, I think it was in The Body Beautiful, the first time I gave him a lyric, and I thought, well, I know how good he is when he writes music first, but can he set a lyric? So I gave him a lyric, and he set it beautifully. And through the years, I discovered that because he had started as a lyricist, he was a wonderful editor. Quite often, he would point out something that needed to be improved. The first time he did that, we had a big fight.
Oh, yeah.
Later, I began to realize how shrewd he was. And so if he had reservations, I took them very seriously, and it always helped the song. And I must say, on occasion, I did the same with the music. I would point out a passage that I thought could be improved.
And did you guys get along?
Yes. I misspoke. I said that we worked together till he died, but that wasn't the case. He had started as a lyricist-composer, and he was dying to get back to writing lyrics. So after we did the Rothschilds, that was the end of our collaboration, and he began to write his own lyrics. And as a matter of fact, the year he died, I believe, he was part of a team, and part of the song was his lyrics.
Oh, my goodness.
Oddly enough, it was a song with the word fiddler in the title. It was a children's song called A Fiddler Crab Am I, and they won a prize for it.
My mind made up.
That he wrote the lyrics for.
He wrote the lyrics, yeah. And as a matter of fact, oh, that was one of Yip Harburg's pieces of advice.
Oh, good.
He said, when you write a lyric and you give it to a composer, if he needs you to change anything to make the melody better, oblige him, because the important thing is to get as good a melody as you can.
I'm fascinated to learn that Harburg was such a big melody man.
Oh, yeah.
Being the great lyricist that he was.
Yeah.
But that he seemed to acknowledge that the melody was somehow...
He worked with great composers.
Well, yeah. Arlen is my all-time favorite American composer.
Arlen was brilliant, yeah.
And their collaboration obviously yielded some hits, some timeless tunes.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea.
Not only hits, but gorgeous songs.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
Somehow Arlen managed to...
Everyone he wrote with benefited from his skill.
He had some weird magic ability to do, I think, what Gershwin always tried to do, obviously succeeded, but to mash together something that sounded Eastern European with something that sounded black. You know, it was the mashup of black and Jewish music that I don't think anybody else did quite so well.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
That's just my own opinion. Not that you asked for it. I noticed also that you worked with Richard Rodgers.
I did one show with Richard Rodgers, and I fell in love with him. As a matter of fact, I met with him, and I was delighted that we were going to work together. And then his daughter called me. She lived in our building, Mary, and she said, my father was taken to the hospital today. He has cancer of the larynx. And I thought, well, there goes our show. But he was operated on, and within a couple of months, he was ready to go back to work. Mm. He couldn't talk for a while, and he had a pipe installed in his throat. But he had a lovely sense of humor. And I remember, for instance, the show was called Rex, about Henry VIII. We had a certain amount of trouble on the road. And Penny Fuller came to me on the road, and she said, Sheldon, I have a problem with this one song. Would you ask Mr. Rogers if there's a way that he can find for me to breathe? There's a whole string of eighth notes, one after the other. And she said, I'm not really a singer. I'm an actress. I'm an actress who sings, and I'm having trouble with this. And I thought, oh, my God, he's going to be upset with this. So I went to him, and I said, when I was feeling comfortable with him, I called him Dick. But on this occasion, I called him Mr. Rogers.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Rogers, Penny Fuller has a problem. He said, well, let me look at the song. And he said, oh, he said, we can put in a bar of rest right here. And he was just so professional and so easy to work with. I just loved him.
Return to cold gray ash too soon. Ours, you said, would be a lasting love. It seems that lasting love has passed us by.
And the songs from that show, do they live on?
We had a nice recording of one of them that was recorded by Andrew Lloyd Webber's wife, Sarah Brightman. She did an album, and he did the orchestration for it. I don't know if the word typical is proper to use here, but it's a typical Richard Rodgers ballad. It's just sweeping and beautiful and melodic, and you hear it, and immediately you fall in love with it.
I cannot wait to hear this song, Away From You, sung at this point by Sarah Brightman. Does sound like Richard Rodgers.
Yeah. And as I said, this orchestration is by Andrew Lloyd Webber. He was a big fan of Richard Rodgers.
He would have to be.
Yeah.
I mean, who isn't? The whole world's a fan of Richard Rodgers. Did he write the melody first?
In that case, he did. Yes, I set the lyric to the music. And although, as I say, he was kind of ill at that time, and he didn't give me much music to write first.
Oh.
So that I had to give him lyrics, and I was very curious to see how he would handle it, and he still had the gift. But I will say, the music was only as good as the lyric. If I gave him a mediocre lyric, the music was mediocre, and I recognized that.
Wow.
I didn't recognize it at the time, but I recognized it later.
Do you think he recognized it, or he was game about every lyric you brought him?
I think intuitively he realized it. I don't think intellectually he analyzed it that way, but I think that's the way he responded to it.
The music was the response.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating to me. Let me ask you a question. You've obviously collaborated with some of the greats. You are a great. They've collaborated with you. Who out there would you collaborate with now?
Well, my wife and I just came back from London, and we saw there's supposed to be a production of Rothschild & Sons there next year. So we went to see the theater that it will be in, and Ragtime was playing. And I listened to that score by Stephen Flaherty, and I thought, wow, that is some score. He's terrific.
Yes, the wheels are turning for us, girl, and the times are starting to roll. Any man can get where he wants to if he's got some fire in his soul. We'll see justice, Sarah, and plenty of men who will stand up and give us our due.
And so are the lyrics.
Yes, they are. Lynn Ahrens, they're wonderful lyrics. But in terms of composers, he's a composer I'd love to work with.
You going to make that happen?
No, he's very comfortable writing with Lynn.
But don't you think if he got a call from Sheldon Harnick, he'd take it seriously?
I don't know, because I had calls. I had a call from Richard Rodgers while I was still working with Jerry Bock, and I had to turn him down.
What show was that?
Mike Stewart had done a book for Arsenic and Old Lace.
Well, look, darlings. Look, I'm frightfully sorry, but I've got an awful shock for you.
Oh, wow.
And Rogers asked if I'd be interested, and I said I would be interested, except that I'm still working with Jerry Bock, and so I can't. And as a matter of fact, nothing ever happened to that idea.
Was that a no because of time or some kind of artistic loyalty? I'm curious.
Oh, it was artistic loyalty.
Only one partner at a time?
Yes, and Jerry felt the same way because he had offers. Although he did have one offer which he accepted, which was to write a film score. And it was for a Jewish film, and he wrote a kind of klezmer score, which was charming.
But he didn't require a partner to do that.
No,
right? He wasn't
cheating
on you.
He had requests to do shows with other lyricists, and he turned them down.
So I know this is an unfair question, but what's a song you just love to listen to?
Well, one of my favorite songs is Dick Rogers' song Lover, in almost any version of it.
I love that you call him Dick, by the way. Let's listen then to Lover of Richard Rodgers. I don't know who wrote these lyrics.
Hart. Larry Hart.
Lover, when you're near me and I hear you speak my name softly in my ear, you breathe a flame. Lover, it's immoral, but why quarrel with our bliss when two lips of coral want to kiss? I say the devil is in you, and to resist you I try, but if you didn't continue, I would die. Lover, please be tender when your tender fears depart. Lover, please surrender to my heart.
The one and only Peggy Lee singing Lover, used both in the Hitchcock classic Rear Window and the Billy Wilder classic Sabrina. Music by Richard Rodgers, or Dick Rodgers, as my guest Sheldon Harnick calls him. In just a moment, we go to the roof to see if there are, in fact, fiddlers. This is the Naked American Songbook. I'm your host, Julian Fleischer, and my guest is lyricist and Broadway legend, Sheldon Harnick. There is so much from Fiddler that is in my DNA. Like, I don't know who I would be without this show.
1 kopeck? Last week you gave me 2 kopecks.
I had a bad week.
So, if you had a bad week, why should I suffer?
So many of the jokes that I tell, so many of the songs that I sing, the way I look at the world is through the lens of this music.
Well, I think all of us, Joe Stein, who wrote the book, and Jerry Bock, who wrote the music, and I, we all, when we decided to do the show, we all remembered our childhoods. We remembered our growing up and our Jewishness and our bar mitzvahs. So all of that was in the fabric of what we wrote.
Yeah, and you had some cosmic line into the collective unconscious of a whole people.
I'd like to think so. It was a very important show to all of us.
Yeah, I don't know how many times a day I say,
Rachel, she can hardly see. She's almost blind.
Tell the truth, Avram. Is your son so much to look at?
But the way he sees and the way she looks, it's a perfect match. It's a philosophy of life for me. Did you all know at the time that you were building something remarkable?
Oh, far from it. We were worried sick. It was a Jewish show. We worried that it would be accepted. We were very worried. And especially when our producer, Harold Prince, told us that we were going to Detroit and that the theater owner said he could only give us a subscription for 3.5 weeks, but we had to be there 5 weeks. So for the last week and a half, there was not a ticket sold.
Ooh.
We went to Detroit. Opening night, Jerome Robbins made very few trims in the show. He wanted to see how everything worked so he would know what to trim. And consequently, the show ran long. I think the show came down about 11:45.
Oof.
And the encouraging thing was that, of course, as it ran late, people began to leave. But they walked up the aisle backwards. So they were obviously trying to stay with the show until they walked out the door. And the horrifying thing was that there was a newspaper strike. So we had no idea how the show had been received, except the clue that we got was that ticket buyers showed up immediately. And by the time the 3.5 weeks were up, I think we were sold out. But I think in Detroit, it was not the show itself that was selling tickets. It was Zero Mostel's performance, because Zero was extraordinary. By the time we got to the next stop, which was Washington, then we had a show. But in Detroit, it was really his performance more than the show. We had a lot of work to do.
In Washington?
In Detroit,
right,
yeah.
Right.
We worked in Detroit and then in Washington. Between Detroit and Washington, I went to my apartment in New York. I was sleeping, and I suddenly heard a crash in the other room. So I took a cane that I had as a bat, and I said in a very loud voice, I've called the police, so you have time to get away. And then I went in the other room and found out that a picture had fallen off the wall and smashed. And to me, it was a terrible omen because the picture was a print that I had bought by a Russian artist, and it was Tevye talking to Sholem Aleichem in the print. And that had fallen off, and there was glass all over the floor. And I remember I went on to Washington, and I was telling one of the people in the cast about this terrible thing that had happened, and he grinned and he said, no, that means we're going to be a smash.
Nice. So, in other words, what you took to be a bad omen, he understood to be a good one.
Absolutely, and he was right.
I wonder why. Is that a thing?
Yeah, because I'm a pessimist and he was an optimist.
There you have it. It was a horse. It was a mule.
It was a horse.
It was a mule.
It was a horse.
It was a mule.
It was a horse.
Sheldon, is it true that the closing number on Atefka was originally a big, fast sort of Broadway number before you slowed it down and it became the finale?
That's not exactly the way it happened. We wrote it as a fast song, and originally it was intended to be the opening of the second act. But it didn't work, so we didn't use it. However, while we were, I think, in Washington, Jerry Robbins had an idea for an ending which needed a new song. And I took that song, which originally was for the beginning of the second act, and I slowed it down because I thought this would be a good ballad, and it became Anatevka.
Oh,
but originally, the rhythm was Anatevka, Anatevka, yadadabadadayimpampada. But that became slowed down and was our final song.
Let's listen to Anatevka from Fiddler on the Roof.
What do we leave? Nothing much. Only Anatevka, 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 underfed, overworked, Anatevka. Where else could Sabbath be so sweet? Anatevka, Anatevka, intimate, obstinate, Anatevka, where I know everyone. Soon I'll be a stranger in a strange new place, searching for an old familiar face. From Anatevka I belong in Anatevka, tumble down, work a day, Anatevka.
Intimate, obstinate, Anatevka. Those are human qualities that you give to a place.
Yeah, that was the way I pictured Anatevka. Or at least that's the way I pictured the inhabitants of Anatevka.
Mm.
Obstinate, but everybody knew each other, so it was an intimate place.
What a risk it must have been to end a show with a number like that.
I was frightened of it, but it worked. Robbins, by that time in his career, had enough experience and enough courage to try that.
It's wildly moving,
yeah.
Moment. At what point, how do I phrase this? At what point did you become aware that this show was going to become somehow global? Was it a slow realization?
I didn't come to the conclusion that it would be global. I came to the conclusion that it was going to be a big hit when we went from Detroit to Washington. Because in Detroit, as I say, we hadn't had reviews. There was a newspaper strike. But we went to Washington, and to my astonishment, there was a long line at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, my God, people must be phoning each other because there are no reviews. And then when we got from Washington to New York, the same thing was true. There was a long line at the box office. And I looked at that line and I thought, this may never happen again in my career. And it never did. But people had been told that this was a show they had to see. So we were very encouraged.
Are there covers of tunes that are not the original versions that you like? Say, for example, a Sinatra version of...
What comes to mind is a jazz version, a jazz saxophone player. I'm blocking on his name right now, but he did an album, jazz versions of Fiddler on the Roof, and they were wonderful.
Do you know about the Temptations version of Sunrise Sunset?
No, I don't.
Would you like to hear it?
Oh, I would love to hear it. I'm very tempted.
It.
One of the reasons I love the song is it's one of the first ones that Jerry Bach and I wrote. He had given me the music, and I wrote the lyric to it, and I discovered that it's such a simple song, even though I'm a violinist, I was able to play it on the piano. And I remember I had gone to Baltimore, where my sister was living at the time, and I played it for her, and when I finished it, I turned around, and she was crying. Mm. And I thought, oh my God, this is a really special song.
Let's listen. I'm speechless. I'm also from Baltimore.
Oh.
Sunrise, sunset.
Oh, boy.
Sunrise, sunset. Swiftly flow the days.
Mm.
wife loves harmonies like these.
Oh, okay.
I love it.
Yeah.
I never heard that.
That's The Temptations in 1969 from a TV show called Motown Does Broadway.
Hmm.
And I think they did almost every major hit from your show.
If I were rich man,
I want to ask you, there were some cute little changes to the lyrics in the medley we just heard. You know,
there were, yeah.
They swapped out, I think.
You thought they were cute, huh?
Well, I did. I did. I mean,
so did I.
You do. That's my question.
Yeah.
Over the years, things get, you know, people knock things around a little bit. How do you feel about that? Is there anything sacred?
I don't, as a rule, I don't like it. I don't like people to take liberties with the lyrics, especially I've heard versions of songs which my lawyer has then tried to get stopped.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't remember one offhand, but I have heard versions where I didn't like what was done.
And also, I mean, the melody in what we just heard was almost unrecognizable.
Yeah.
How would Jerry Bach have felt about that?
I think he would feel terrible about that.
I'm curious, I mean, if you don't mind my probing a little further in this, because the songs are so well known, because they are so standard, in some sense, we all have the authoritative version in our brains. And so it can be sort of fun as a listener, and I say this strictly as a listener, to hear someone play with a little bit, knowing what the original sounds like. If it were a song that nobody knew, I would find myself as a writer perhaps even more upset.
I think the truth is that it all depends on what they do.
Right.
If what they do I find charming, then I thought, oh, I like that.
Right.
If it's something that I object to, then I don't like it.
That's interesting. Because Sinatra, of course, you know, changed, yeah, swapped out words, and I don't know a lot of songwriters who were objecting to that. You know?
No.
But maybe that was just the spirit of it.
It's, no, I would write him a letter and say, Frank, please change my lyric.
Just record it.
Yeah.
Sheldon Harnick, I am so grateful for today and, frankly, for a whole lifetime of extraordinary songs.
That's very lovely to hear. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this afternoon.
Good. I'm going to make sure that we have a tape of you saying that. The Naked American Songbook is a production of the Jonathan Channel, WNYC, and WQXR in New York City. Thanks again to Sheldon Harnick.
I talked to Sheldon Harnick.
His opera, Lady Bird, is getting its New York premiere this spring at the Danny Kaye Playhouse. He is 92 years old, and he is still writing and creating beautiful music. Here at the Naked American Songbook, we have our traditions, too. Aaron Dalton is Muddle the Taylor. Ellie Smerling is Chavala. Hilary Bonhomme is Fromisera. Mike Shoeb is the Cossacks, and I mean all of them, and they are very much at the door. Please do us a favor. If you like the show, tell a friend. Most podcast apps make it very easy to share via text or via email, and here at the Naked American Songbook, we love nothing more than sharing. Our theme music is written and produced by me. I'm Julian Fleischer. Thank you for listening, thank you for sharing, and thank you for keeping it naked.
I hadn't thought of that, but I will do everything I can to make sure it is.
Yeah. Make it so, Sheldon.
Yeah.
I mean, the world needs to hear it.
You're absolutely right. The world does need to hear it.
All right.
And the world will hear it, by God.
A giggle.
A giggle.